Welcome to the 123rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 48 years to the day since the highest wicket taker in Test cricket was born. Happy birthday, Murali.
And if you love us as much as you love Murali, then hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review. I don't think anyone loves us as much as they love Murali. So even if you don't love us as much as you love Murali and you just like the podcast, please do review us on iTunes. It's a great way for people to find us. In fact, they can't find us if you don't. So hop over and it is much appreciated. In today's episode, we've both been watching a lot of videos on the internet, it turns out, and we're going to be talking about some of our highlights there. I'm going to be taking us back to a game that happened in 1944, a game threatened by bombs at Lord's in 1944, and we are going to review Through the Remembered Gate by Stephen Chalke. So, Andy, life in lockdown has had you browsing YouTube.
Yeah, I think if, like me, you've ever watched old cricket footage on YouTube, you almost certainly have Rob Moody, a.k.a. the world-famous Robber Linda 2, to thank. He was once described by Crick Info as the ultimate cricket librarian, and he is providing an invaluable service right now through lockdown to cricket-starved fans all over the world with constant enthusiasm and, I think, just as impressively, sort of constant good humour. He's been responding to endless requests from fans to seek out clips from his archive. You know, people are tweeting all sorts at him. I'll give you one example that I think shows off his rather wonderful superpowers. The journalist and former guest on this podcast, actually, Vitusha Nahantaraja, asked Robert Linda whether he had Derbyshire spinner David Wainwright dismissing Gloucestershire's Chris Dent with a wrong'un from a 2014 one-day match. We're getting pretty niche here. Mm. Within minutes, Robert Linda had it up on Twitter. And I think just to add to the lockdown fun, several bored, self-isolating players and former players are now joining in to comment on clips of them. So we've had Jeff Boycott, Ricky Ponting, Shoaib Akhtar getting involved. So yes, splendid fun for many cricket-starved fans out there.
And it's also a nice opportunity at the moment while you know, new games have paused to be able to go down memory lane a little bit. And I've certainly been loving some of the games that have been put up and been relived, you know, even to the extent of Crick Info are reliving games on their site just with the kind of live scores. And I've sat there actually following live scores of games, actually quite engrossed in them. And I think there's quite a nice opportunity at the moment to be able to lavish time and attention on former games. That's... One question I've always had about good old Robert Linda is whether actually he has any of the rights to be putting this stuff up, and I've always been terrified of the day that some officious copyright person comes along and just shuts down his account, because that would be an enormous loss for cricket.
So very recently the ICC basically said to him, look, you need to take down all the stuff from our tournament, which was actually linked to the fact that they, I don't know if they've got around to it yet actually, but they are going to put it out on their website, so that was not reasonable. I think the thing is, and perhaps part of the reason he's been left at least mostly alone, is that it really is a triumph of the amateur over the professionals. Yep. I mean, you would assume that somewhere in the world all of this stuff was on an archive. It turns out the answer it isn't. He apparently is regularly asked by former players, oh, you know, could I possibly have the highlights of this? Because no one else has kept it, which is quite extraordinary. You know, he has this archive of terabytes of computer data, all these DVDs, and yeah, and I mean, it's yet another example in cricket of the dedicated amateur getting one over the rest. Now you've been benefiting from some other video footage, maybe less historic but classic in its own way.
Yeah, so I mean, look, one of the results of the current situation is that every celebrity across the world has equipped themselves with sort of home recording equipment and are showing us in different ways the interiors of their homes, mostly just to show off about how much more space they have than we do. On the whole, I think that's pretty tedious, but there has been an impressive side to it, which is how wonderful it is to watch really, really highly skilled people getting bored and putting those skills to good use and to creative use as well. So I will confess that I'd never actually heard of the Scottish keeper batsman Matthew Cross until he recently got into a Twitter exchange with Sean Pollock, the South African fast bowler, former South African fast bowler. And essentially they're having a competition between themselves to see who can bounce a golf ball off the most objects and then into a cup. I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but it's actually one of those moments when you realize that the level of innate skill in professional sportsmen and women is just so far beyond what us mere mortals can dream about. And there is something really satisfying about watching these highly skilled people get bored and just having fun. So their videos progress from the first one is just, he's just throwing a ball into a cup across a room. And then they progress into some really, really kind of intricate things where in the latest one, for instance, Cross chips a golf ball and he bounces it off four angled bats lying on the floor and then into an upturned can. And what's also quite fun is the kind of banter and rivalry that comes with this. So he actually ends that video, which is again the kind of next level of the challenge with Pollock, with a little clip, probably found by Rob Linder, a little clip of when Sean Pollock's batting at the crease and Kumar Sangakkara is standing behind him, and the stump mic picks up Sangakkara saying, "Oh, you know, the weight of the country, you know, however many million people, the weight of the country is on your shoulders." And it's the next layer of laying down the gauntlet to Pollock. So it's quite a it's just a really, really fun kind of exchange. And actually, for someone like Matthew Cross, who's a keeper batsman with a fairly modest record, it has to be said, you know, maybe ironically, this is the moment when he will come most firmly into the limelight, is actually when he's unable to play.
So I looked this up following your pointer, and it's pretty intriguing in that for a start you think, well, it's just quite an odd thing to decide to do, because some of the challenges, so I quite enjoyed Kane Williamson, I don't know if you saw, who was doing slip catches with his dog, and Kane Williamson is, you know,
yeah, there's a whole series of those.
Oh, is that now? That's now spawned.
Yeah, there are loads of cricketers who are doing
exactly. I've no doubt, however, that Kane did it best, though.
I'm sure he did.
How did you come? You know, how do you come up with this golf ball thing? But then the other thing about it is, and I don't want to be really cynical, if I had, just slightly disputing your point about different levels of skill, if I committed the entirety of my lockdown to doing this, I reckon I'd get there, wouldn't I? If I
true,
hit a golf ball
true,
enough
and
times,
maybe, maybe then that is the difference between us and professional sports people, that for us, we wouldn't just commit. Because sure, they're trying it 1,000 times, and then they're releasing the video of the time they actually get it. Clearly, we're not seeing all the attempts that fail. So maybe the difference is just the fact that these people have more patience and dedication and willingness to do it again and again and again than we do.
Otherwise, we'd both be international cricketers. From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to take us back to another time, back in the 1940s, when cricket across the world was also interrupted.
So, in many ways, cricket is surely the most interrupted game in existence. I mean, you turn up to a game of cricket, and you kind of almost, particularly if you're in England, you almost expect there to be some kind of delay in play. And that's not the same for any other game, which is, you know, if it's going to happen, it's going to carry on regardless. And obviously the reason for that is simply because of the weather. But despite that, it's pretty rare that the game across the world is stopped as it is now. And I was thinking about this, and I was looking back to when this happened last, and I had assumed that that was during the Second World War. But actually, it's not actually the case that the Second World War put a halt to cricket across the board. Clearly, the kind of, you know, teams travelling around the world to play one another was halted for a while. There weren't, you know, ships going from Portsmouth to Sydney to carry cricketers for the Ashes. And there are actually still some efforts to continue the county championship in 1939 and 1940. The championship itself, the county championship, didn't continue simply because of the number of cricketers on active duty. They just decided they couldn't actually get the usual county teams out, even when they, you know, called in the reserves. But the game did continue to be played very regularly to a high level across the country, with the players who were in England and also those who were on leave from active service. And it's also interesting to remember, as a brief aside, that, and I hadn't actually quite realised this, that for a large part of the war. There weren't actually very many English troops on active service outside England for the middle part of the year. Actually, most of the troops were stationed in the UK, and so a way of keeping those troops entertained was to continue playing games like cricket. Soccer also kept on happening regularly throughout the majority of the Second World War.
And my understanding was this was also always fraught with some quite difficult ethical debates, in that I understand the government, both with football and cricket, was always really positive for it to keep going, because I think there was a recognition of its importance for morale, which I must admit, you know, there are very obvious parallels, I guess, to what's going on now mm-hmm. with coronavirus and debates about when sport should restart. But I mean, do you get a sense of to what extent, was there an extent to which the cricketers themselves found themselves on either side of that debate about, you know, we it's in the national interest for us to play on, or actually it's not appropriate with everything else that's going on for us to play on?
I don't think there was a sense really of what was appropriate or not, because I think there was simply a sense that yes, we're you know, where people were called up and were on active service, they were on active service, but there are periods of leave built into that, and it was during those periods of leave that people did play the game. So it wasn't as though people were exempt from going on active service or in any way endangering the war effort by continuing to play cricket. And I think there was this kind of slightly patriotic sense that things like cricket, you know, this particularly English thing, needed to continue at a time when, you know, when kind of national identity and the cause of Englishness almost was being called into question, particularly because essentially the war was being played against a non-cricketing nation. Mm. Here we are kind of you know, doing something that is so much a part of who we are. If we can't carry on playing cricket, why the hell are we playing this war? Probably mm. stating it a bit strongly, but you know what I mean, there is that kind of sense of national identity, and that meant that the game continued even when you know, the doodle bugs, the V1 flying bombs, started dropping quite heavily on targets in and around London at the very end of the war in 1944. And Lords had continued to have a very packed schedule throughout the war years, and regularly drew large crowds coming to watch games. And this was true even when the bombing happened quite heavily on London. And there was a game that happened on the 29th of July 1944. So again, the backdrop is London is being bombed regularly, but 3,000 spectators turn up to watch an exhibition match at the end of July, with the Royal Air Force playing against an army side. And this was very much explicitly touted as an exhibition game, as an opportunity to come and see your heroes, you know, people recently returned from the front, together with some kind of guest staff. And it was quite a lineup that turned out on Lords that day. So Morris Leyland, Godfrey Evans, Gubby Allen, Bill Edridge, Les Ames all turned out, all very, very fine England international players in their own right. But the star attraction was Wally Hammond, who I think, you know, was literally a few days back from actually active service on the front, came back and straight into Lords. So that was really the draw card for everyone to turn up.
Presumably one of the consequences of coming, as you say, straight from active service, straight into the game, was that these were players who were quite under-trained. I mean, maybe this was an era where actually, compared to current players, that they would often... Well, I'm not actually sure that's true, but it must be quite odd to have come from a situation where you were serving to then have a cricket bat in your hand a couple of days later.
Yeah, and I suspect that the point was less about... the sheer quality and professionalism of the play, and more about the joy of playing cricket and everyone kind of getting into that spirit of it, I suspect. And certainly, look, it was a one day game. The idea wasn't that this was a tussle over the usual, you know, 5 day county game or 4 day county game. It was a one day game exhibition match as well. So I think very much the idea was to hit out and have a bit of fun. The game, I mean, talking of delays to play, of course it rains overnight. And so the start to the day's play is delayed. And it eventually happens that it starts at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And about an hour after play begins, a doodlebug is heard from the ground. It's quite a regular sound in the London skies at that point, quite a distinctive sound as well. And everyone knows what that buzz means. And I think everyone's used to that. There have been about 8,000 of these things dropped on the capital in just a few months before. However, the sound of a doodlebug is in itself not threatening. The sound that is threatening is the moment that it goes silent, because the way that it worked was that it flew across and then the engine cuts out. And when the engine cuts out, it then drops to the ground and explodes. So everyone hears the sound, not concerned, and then suddenly there's silence. And there's silence across Lourdes, and there are these scenes where the spectators, all of these spectators in the ground, the 3,000 spectators, all run for cover. The players on the pitch all drop to the ground to try and protect themselves as best they can when this thing falls. At the moment that it cuts out, Bob Wyatt, the ex-England Test captain, is in the middle of his run-up. He drops straight to the ground, 5 or 6 paces from the pitch. And there's this amazing picture, actually, of the Army batsman Jack Robertson, the RAF wicketkeeper Andy Wilson, and then Bill Edridge and Austin Matthews all just lying flat on the ground at this point. It's one of those pictures that you look at and go, wow, there's got to be a story there. And indeed, the story is quite remarkable. In the event the bomb misses Lourdes, it falls in Regent's Park, just a few hundred yards away. And there's this beautiful description in Wisden where it kind of indignantly describes the first flying bomb to menace Lourdes during the progress of the match, as if it's kind of, you know, it's a bit of a breach of protocol and etiquette for this flying bomb to have come, you know, threatened the ground while play is happening. What's interesting is that straight away afterwards, everyone gets back on their feet, dusts off their whites, and the game resumes. And the game resumes by Wyatt not going back to the top of his run, but by Wyatt just standing up 3 or 4 paces from the wicket and just carrying on and bowling from there. And there's a beautiful sense that, you know, that was just a brief pause to the game. He gets up and everything continues straight away. And then Robertson, the batsman, actually hits the next ball into the stands for 6. And so there's this really fantastic and I think very, you know, beautifully kind of English sense of, yep, we've all just been threatened by death, but actually at this moment we are just going to carry on as if nothing had happened. I mean, you know, if there was a bomb scare in a cricket ground nowadays, you wouldn't be having, you know, carrying on the game in any sense whatsoever straight away.
But it fits with exactly what you were setting out earlier, you know, why the game was happening at all was this sense of, you know, what are we fighting for? We must, what we value must go on. And I think, and you know, don't want to overdo this, but in terms of the comparison to now, I think it's one of the things that's making the response really difficult, I think, for a lot of people, is that, you know, keep calm and carry on in some ways is a much easier message, or at least a much more easier message to get behind than keep calm and give up everything you enjoy doing. Extraordinary to take that to the extreme of literally not recommencing your run-up.
Yeah, exactly. Don't even break your stride because you've been threatened by a bomb. I mean, it's interesting as well to think back, when you take a step back, to think about the fact that while this game is happening in July 1944 is when the Battle of Normandy is playing out, when Allied troops are going into France to basically win control of France and starting course the train of events that decide the outcome of the war. And there's this little patch of England with these soldiers on it, you know, going about its usual business while the kind of theatre of war and one of the most decisive moments in 20th century history is kind of playing out. As it turns out, the game goes on to be drawn. So the Army score 211 off their 57 overs, and the RAF managed to cling on at 129 for 9 and cling on for the draw. Across the other side of London at the same time, the Oval actually has a very different way of spending the war. So rather than carrying on as an active cricket pitch, the turf's ripped up, it's converted into a prisoner of war camp. And again, there are these quite amazing pictures you can still really get the sense of the Oval, but with these kind of barbed wire sort of enclosures built across it. In the end, actually, it was never even used as a prisoner of war camp, and apparently it took a long, long time to get the Oval pitch back to a state after the war where it could actually have cricket played on it. Such was the kind of level of construction that happened there during the war to get this prisoner of war camp happening. But yeah, overall, it's just interesting to think of cricket being a game that is so easily stopped by a drop of rain, and yet here is an instance where, threatened with bomb and death, it just carries on kind of regardless despite that. the review. And this episode, we have been reading our first book, actually, remarkably, given his the strength of his catalogue, our first book by Stephen Chalk. And we've been reading Through the Remembered Gate, published just last year in 2019. Stephen Chalk is an author, came to cricket writing fairly late in life. He's the publisher and founder of Fairfield Books and an enthusiastic village cricketer. Andy, what is Through the Remembered Gate about?
So in some ways, it's kind of a valedictory. It's Stephen Chalk sort of bringing his whole career together. It's partly an autobiography. We get stories from all parts of his life. It's partly a greatest hits. So he's pulling out some of his most memorable interviews with cricketers from across the ages. And then he also takes time to reflect on the process of writing and also the process of publishing, which I guess are sort of two linked but quite different undertakings. Not surprisingly, one recurrent theme is the whole business of oral history, which, you know, he discusses different phrases for it. He talks about the idea of assisted biography as well. But this whole business of what does it mean to collect and use and kind of encourage other people's stories. And he talks about kind of the tricks involved in that. And, well, sorry, tricks is the wrong word. The skills and the art involved in that. I mean, were there things that struck you about that, about how what's made him so successful in doing that?
Yeah, so I suppose it's worth just the kind of Stephen Chalk story is that he, you know, always a cricket fan, an amateur kind of village cricketer, he ends up getting deciding that he wants to improve his game, and he gets some training from an old pro, and he gets talking to this old pro and realizing, wow, there are some amazing stories here. This guy puts him onto others, and he ends up kind of making a career, in inverted commas, of talking to cricketers of past decades. So he starts off writing a book about cricketers in the 1950s, collecting their stories and kind of working with them to tell their memories and tell their stories. And one of the things that I thought was really powerful about that was this sense of cricketers who wouldn't necessarily know, you know, be able to go out and write their own book and, you know, form it into something that was coherent and then even get it published, but yet have such a trove of memories and stories that are directly from the players, that aren't things that are, you know, garnered from match reports or criticism, but are very much based around players themselves. And out of that, you actually get these amazing stories of people who otherwise wouldn't have been heard of. And I mean, the really kind of moving example for me is the story of Bob Appleyard, the cricketer who overcame enormous adversity in terms of ill health to turn himself into one of the finest bowlers in the game. And here is someone who, by the time that Stephen Chalk comes into contact with him, is, you know, effectively languishing in obscurity. And through the process of oral history, assisted biography, as you say, and through the process of writing, is able to quite rightly take his place in the kind of history of cricket in a way that he otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
And Chalk makes the point, I mean, it really changes Appleyard's life. I mean, he ends up becoming president at Yorkshire, partly as a result of the book. Mm. I think one of the fascinating things is because of Chalk's interest in all county cricketers, and actually a particular decision he makes early on to be focused on those who haven't had their story told, you get a lot of nearly stories. Not surprisingly, you get a lot of stories of people who had some success in the game but also didn't maybe quite get to where they wanted to. And that in itself, I think, is quite moving and often, frankly, more interesting than the stories of endless success.
Yep.
One thing that inevitably Chalk runs into again and again is the whole issue of nostalgia, and Chalk is well aware of the perils of nostalgia. He at one point, sort of seemingly responding to criticism he's had before, he says he doesn't want to be seen as a nostalgia monger, but in the very same pages he talks about the fact that he cannot shake a sense that something might have been lost from the game of cricket. And I think it's a really interesting tension in the book that Chalk is at pains to be like, to be very clear on the benefits and improvements of the modern game, But the writing is infused with a sort of passion for a previous age. And I've also got no doubt that that's a key part of the work's popularity. I think so many people have loved it for that very reason.
Yeah, there is a beautiful kind of Blue Remembered Hills type, you know, aspect to this. I mean, even this book is called Through the Remembered Gate, and you know, the cover of it is an illustration of an old man walking through a gate in a hedge onto a kind of village green, in a way that is very much a sense that we're stepping through something back into the past. And there is a kind of element of a forgotten age here, both in the stories, the subject matter, but also the way that Stephen Chalk writes, which I actually think is really beautiful and beautifully crafted, but certainly is from, you know, in a way from a different age. And I think it's useful that he is so aware of that, because it actually allows him to be quite unabashed about stepping back and really celebrating the past. And I think that's really what the book and his overall output is about, is about celebrating the past, not necessarily in comparison with the present, and I think often it's weakest when it is in comparison with the present, but just the past for the past's sake, actually.
Absolutely, and I think obviously it has struck a chord with an awful lot of people who were there and wanted to reconnect with those memories, but also for people like us who weren't, and it's a wonderful insight into that time of the game. You touched on his style, which I agree, I think he is in many ways a very fine writer. I think it's quite a distinctive style, and and I mean this in a positive way, in that it meanders. And I think in the wrong sort of book, in a different sort of book, it would be the wrong sort of style. And I think you'd be tempted to say, you know, where's the editor? We need to cut this.
Yep.
But I think that would be to miss the point in this book. It's about memory. It's about wallowing in memory. And it's about the connection between memories. I confess there was one moment where we get an extended anecdote about a bus driver refusing a dirty 50p piece, which was the one moment in the whole book where I thought, no, someone needed to say to Stephen, this does not make the cut.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we have read a few books for this podcast where people have been, people outside the game have had passions about particular areas of the game, and they've written about those, and they have resulted in some of the most boring pieces of cricket writing I think we've come across. There's that book, for instance, about the, you know, what happened to the ball that was hit for six sixes,
yeah.
Which was, you know, borderline unreadable. And I think one of the great things about Stephen Chalk is A, he's a great writer. B, he is kind of an editor. He is an editor by craft as well. And so he does have a clear sense of the audience, I think, in his head when he's writing about these things. But I think also he has a nose for what's a good story and what's not a good story. And so that 50p bus anecdote aside, he spends a lot of the book actually talking about the challenge of crafting people's memories, and it not just being carte blanche for someone to splurge about whatever they want to talk about, but actually needing to shape a narrative, you know, a narrative in that way. And I think out of that we get some amazing sort of tidbits. There's this beautiful story of a Gloucestershire game in 1957 where I think it's Gloucestershire who think that they've won. They celebrate, they've hit the winning runs, they celebrate, they go back to the dressing room, they're downing pints, and then the scorers actually work out that they've actually got the scoring wrong and they actually need one more run to win. And so good old Sam Cook, the Gloucestershire batsman, has to go back out into the middle. He's just downed a pint. He has to go back out into the middle in order to hit the winning run. Great anecdote in and of itself. But what I think is even better is the fact that Chalk writes up this anecdote, goes out in a book, and then he gets a letter a few weeks later from a boy who says, well, a man who was a boy then, who says he was at that game. He was scoring along, as you do when you're sitting on the boundaries. And then he gets to the end and he turns to his grandfather and he says, hang on, I actually think the scores are tied. And his grandfather says, don't be so silly. They've got proper scorers. They don't make mistakes like that. And they leave the game. And I think that's just a beautiful illustration of A, bringing an anecdote from the past to life, but also doing that in a way that connects with cricket lovers and actually stitches that into the fabric of the game as it is now as well, and into other people's memories too.
Well, he talks about this point that you have to build the trust, and part of that is that you have to be genuinely interested in the story, and that comes across again and again. I think, as you say, he's got a great eye for the material, and he focuses on those cricketers for whom he has genuine interest, for whom there's something about their life story, something about their particular outlook. that causes him to have a genuine interest. And it actually gets to quite a moving phase, particularly later in the book, where he finds himself speaking at quite a few of the funerals of the cricketers he's worked with. And I must admit, as a reader, you suddenly think, God, this is almost becoming a rather grim part-time job for him. But he clearly, it's an extension of that passion, it's an extension of that interest, and actually it's a rather wonderful way of completing his work. You know, he's paid tribute to them through his writing, and is now paying tribute at that sort of final moment, in that final memorial.
And it's a sense of the power of that writing as well, the fact that his writing and the way that he has collected the anecdotes of these people does become the memorial, the lasting legacy of some of these quite amazing cricketers. So I think it's fair to say that we're going to be probably diving a bit more into Stephen Chalke's books over the next little while. Was there one that you kind of particularly caught your eye in terms of, one of the full works, assisted biographies of one of these cricketers that you thought to dive into?
That's an interesting question. I think as you said at the start, I think the Bob Appleyard story is clearly a really interesting one. But I think you get the feeling that actually it's not really about picking the name, is it? You sort of think you could dive into any of his works and find something useful and interesting. And again, I mean, it seems an odd segue, but a little bit how I was talking about what the amateur can add to cricket in the way that Rob Alinda does with his YouTube videos. Mm. I mean, isn't this another wonderful example? I mean, didn't the game of cricket need a Stephen Chalke, a slight obsessive, to go around and do this documenting, to do this assisted history? Because without him doing it, it appeared no one else did.
Totally. So that is Through the Remembered Gate by Stephen Chalke, published by Stephen Chalke's own publishing company, Fairfield Books. And that was the 123rd episode of Reverse Swept Radio.